personal views and opinions expressed by our podcast guests are their own and are not legal advice or official statements by their organizations. Hello, my name is Debbie Reynolds. They call me the Data Diva. This is the Data Diva Talks Privacy podcast, where we discuss data privacy issues with industry leaders around the world with information that businesses need to know now. I have a special guest on the show, Brendan Sullivan. He is the CEO of Sullivan Strickler. Welcome to the show.
Hi, Debbie. It's great to be here. Looking forward to it.
Well, this is going to be a fun podcast. So, Brendan, we met on LinkedIn. You called me up. You invited me to Atlanta to go to a roundtable, which was great, with you and some of your clients. And you're in the data retrieval space. To me, I think it's really fascinating because I think this is something that all companies deal with, but they think it's in the back room. We don't have to worry about it. But what we're seeing in terms of especially privacy, you know, we have laws and regulations that are saying, hey, what are you doing with this data? How long are you keeping this data? Like, why do you have it? So tell me a little bit about what you like, your trajectory into, you know, your work in data and, you know, to where you are now.
So I graduated as an electronics and telecommunications engineer, and then moved into a company that developed 64K static RAMs, which is really aging me. So that was back in about 1984, 85. And then 85, I moved to a company that was developing the world's first square tape cartridge with IBM. I didn't work for IBM, but we were working with IBM. It was a 3480 tape cartridge back in 85. So since 85, I haven't really left tape or backup since then. So it's been a kind of a lifelong career in that area. So initially, I would say the first 15, 16 years of that was in development, production, development, marketing, and selling of backup tape technology, 3480. We built the first DLT tape cartridges that was part, and I was a member of the team that did that. So a lot of the old technologies, and we also retired the last 9-track tape technology. So it's always been tape and backup. And then at around about the late 1990s, we were getting squeezed out, if you like, from the tape manufacturing, from being an effective tape manufacturer. The technology was getting extremely dense in terms of the recording that lent itself much more to companies like Sony and Fuji, Fujifilm to develop, and we needed to reinvent ourselves. And so I was tasked with part of that, you know, where could we take our technology? So we, at that point, we moved to services, and I moved to the States in 99. I should say I worked for a company called Anacomp at the time, Anacomp Magnetics. And many of the listeners out there might know that Anacomp Magnetics actually got spun off to form EMAG Solutions. So it was originally Anacomp. And so as we were reinventing ourselves, that we had the idea that we would offer recovery services from backup tape rather than just manufacture of backup tapes. And we stumbled across Enron matter, and we stumbled into doing work on the Enron matter and then doing work on Zuba Lake versus UBS. And that really was the trigger for us to get into more of the legal compliance side of data services. So from that moment on, we built technology to be able to restore and produce data from backup environments in the 2000s. 2011, I had a couple of years. I left the company after 20 something years and had a couple of years working for Alex Partners as a legacy data remediation consultant. And 2013, I came back into the specific backup industry, so to speak, and formed Sullivan Strickler. So we're coming up to 10 years old, and we've been building a company that specializes in restoration, production, advisory, consulting services in and around primarily the kind of the backup market. But I would say in the last 5-6 years, the vast majority of our technical development has been triggered, if you like, by changing regulations and data privacy requirements on that data. And that's kind of lent itself to the tools and services that, we now offer.
Fantastic. And I got a chance to tour your facilities. Very impressive. I would love to talk with you a little bit just about legacy data in general, right? So okay. This is a topic I like to talk about because I feel like not enough people talk about legacy data. So all companies, unless they're brand new, right, have some type of legacy data. So maybe something, you know, stuff that has maybe aged out in some way. Maybe it's storing data from maybe software that people no longer have or use. So tell me about just the legacy data problem. I think it's a huge problem. So I think legacy data is a huge problem because companies keep data too long, first of all. And then a lot of times they don't have a good strategy for how to deal with data at the end of its data lifecycle. Tell me a little bit about that.
Yeah, there's a lot to unpick in that question. So what I would start by saying is, you know, from my perspective, I think the legacy data problem, as it so to speak, really came with Windows and Unix. In terms of, you know, if you go back 30 years, when the vast majority of data that was being created and backed up were managed on things like Unisys systems, IBM mainframes, IBM AS400s, and particularly the mainframes, and the way that they managed data in the 70s and 80s, it was much more transactional type management process, in that you would create a data set, write it to tape, update that data set, rewrite it to tape. So there was a much more daily backing up of data. And of course, what that meant largely was that the terminal was dumb, so to speak, in that it didn't have its own storage where this data was created. And but what it also meant is that you weren't backing up junk that you didn't have to back up. So as the PC came to fore and processing in and around Windows and Unix environments developed, it became much more economical, or it was economical for programs to be run locally, as in software application programs to be run locally, and then archived and then backed up either on a daily, weekly, different methodology, you know, incremental, differential, and full type backups. And of course, what this meant was that data was dumped to disk and then backed up to tape, and then subsequently backed up to disk, like a NAS or a SAN type environment, but it was all together. And so the actual data that was being backed up, the IT administrators of the day, their major challenge was their backup window, which meant that, you know, you get a certain amount of time at the end of the day or at the end of the week to back up the data from the company, from all of these different people that were networked on the system. And the push was, we got to back it up faster and we got to back it up cheaper. And so the software companies answered with, okay, we've got a great new way of multiplexing or multi-threading, or we'll put a whole string of tape drives together and we'll back up the different portions of data that you've got to back up as fast as you can. And if you imagine, it's like a bucket of all sorts of different types of data that gets backed up as quickly as it possibly can. And then that bucket is your media repository, whether it be a tape or a disk. And that's great. You've backed it up. You've done it quickly. You've got it safe. But regulations that have come since come in, litigation that since comes in, that since shows itself requires the unraveling. And I think the key is, you know, when you look, when you talk to people about backup software, the key is in the language. You're talking about backup software. Very few back in the day called it backup and recovery or backup restore software. So there was much more focus on backing it up quickly rather than retrieval of it. And what privacy regulations and other regulations have since proven is that it's the finding of that data and working of that data that has made it a problem. And so consequently, I think you could really term two ways to organize data, two fundamental ways. You either get it right at the start, where you push data into known locations so that they can be easily identified and therefore retrieved, or you have to index the lot to figure out what you've got after the event. And we've been going through a 20, 25 year transition where both those sides of the field have been worked on, in that records information management techniques and rules, the ability to categorize and classify data correctly has dramatically improved with companies as they've taken this far more seriously. And the ability to index and search with, you know, technology, machine learning, AI type technologies and search platforms have made it easier to find it. So we're solving the problem from two angles, or trying to solve the problem from two angles. But we have a massive bucket of largely unstructured data that is legacy data that we don't know what it is. We don't know where it is. But we do know that regulators think it's important. Companies think it's important. Litigators think it's important. And candidly, that's why Sullivan Strickler exists. That's what we're in business for.
Very good. I would like to talk about the cloud a bit. So before the cloud, so people had data on servers, right? They had these backup routines. So, and I want to touch on something that you and I had a chat on LinkedIn. I thought was a very interesting insight that you made, which was backups were only seen or should have been seen as kind of short-term storage. And now people see it as something different. But I want to talk to you about that. And then also, when people started putting things in the cloud, some people would say, well, since it's in the cloud, I don't need a backup of it, right? But I don't think that that's true. Because unless you pay extra for it to be backed up in some type of way, the way that the cloud environment works, they store things in real time for you. So let's say John is a disgruntled employee. He goes into the cloud, deletes all your stuff. You go back to the cloud vendor. You're like, well, you know, this happened like 2 days ago. John deleted all the stuff. And they're like, well, it sucks to be you, kind of, right? So tell me about that issue with the cloud. And then also your thought about, you know, backups really initially being supposed to be short-term storage until you can update it.
So it's heavily misunderstood in terms of you know, what a backup is or what it should be, and I think it's been corrected largely as professional companies over the years have recognized how it was how data was being managed inappropriately, and now it is largely getting managed much more appropriately. So I would define backup as a short-term duplication of data. So if I'm creating data in a company on day one, and I want to, you know, if there's a disaster of some description, whether a server goes down, there's a fire or an accident or something like that, I need to get that data back following day or the following week, or I write it over. I might write that data over. So if I'm creating data on day one, and then I leave and I go home and I come back and I create data, slightly different data the following day, then it makes perfect sense for me to have a backup of that data on day one. And then I discard it on day two. So because I've refreshed it. Now, if I don't do that, then what I'm doing is, if I'm creating 100 gigabytes on day one and 100 gigabytes on day two, then, you know, I've got 200 gigabytes when maybe I only need 105 gigabytes, so to speak. So backup needs to be recognized for what it is. It's a short-term duplication of data. Archiving is different. It's data that you have to keep, data that will not change in a short period of time, and data that you might have to keep for 7 years or 5 years or whatever it is. And so you push it to a similar repository, a similar media repository for safekeeping. And I think, you know, what's happened over the last 20, 30 years is we backed up everything, and the term archive and backup have not really been distinguished adequately. And they've resulted in a huge amount of what I would call junk. You know, when you're creating any data in an organization, you might have data that you need for business, data that you need for regulatory reasons, for compliance audits, and data that you might have to preserve for litigation. And outside of that, everything else really is junk. And so when we're, you know, and it's definitely in vogue to move a lot of data to the cloud now, it's probably a good archive platform. I don't think it's a good backup platform. I don't think anybody would argue that it was a good backup platform for that, because it's largely been shown that actually the egress data, pulling it out of cloud, is extremely expensive and can be slow. Putting it in there, if you're not going to touch it frequently, can be very cost effective. So I think it makes a lot of sense for companies to put the minimum amount of data in the cloud as possible, and data that is actually going to be archived and not looked at on a regular basis. Otherwise, it's going to get expensive and it's going to cause problems. And not least of which, various organizations like Gartner have done research into typical data that gets put to storage repositories, whether it be archive or backup. And outside of that business, regulatory, or litigation pool, the junk, you know, which might be a personal photograph that's attached to an email, you know, that a friend has sent you or something like that. Do you really want to pay money to keep that and in five different instances across your backup repository? Not least of which, there's all sorts of risk data that you don't want out there, data that might have been risk-free to have in your organization on day one, but by day 10, it's a high risk, it's a liability. So I think pushing data to the cloud needs to be extremely intelligent. Records management needs to play a very, very big role in that to avoid what will certainly be expensive, problematic issues going forward when it comes time to retrieving it.
Let's talk about duplication or deduplication, right? So keeping the same copy of the same thing over and over and over, as you say, gets very expensive. And this has been the way that people did it forever because they felt that was just the safest way. But we know as a result of a lot of, you know, current and pending regulations, now there are regulations around privacy that are saying you should only keep data, you know, unless you have some other reason, keep it no longer than is necessary. So that's like a whole new world in terms of how people kept stuff. Because I know I used to remember, you know, when people were running out of room, you know, let's say they were doing like a hot backup on a, you know, server to server, they will say, well, just buy a new server, right? And just throw it back up on there. And that just keep going on and on. So I know companies still have those issues. But talk to me about the challenge that companies create for themselves when they store duplicates and how you help them with that.
Yeah. So again, a lot to comment on that. I think the... You know, if you take a typical or a standard organization that has a backup or an archive system, it can be very cost effective to push that data to whatever the media might be, whether it be, you know, tape, typically in the older days, but also NAS and SAN and various other network storage type applications. the duplication of data is largely initiated by the problem of a poorly understood retention schedule, how long you need to keep stuff, and therefore when you are backing it up, are you backing up the same data on multiple occasions, and where is that data going? We would classify data by type, by category, as sessions. And that's largely how backup software companies would manage data. And so that data, for example, if I have a print server, or if I have a Microsoft Exchange server, or a SharePoint, or Oracle database, whatever it is, the servers that get have that data backed up from, the backup softwares organize them into sessions. So I might back up my Oracle data as a backup session, and I might back up my print server as a backup session. And then all of those sessions can go to the same repository, but they may have different retention schedules. In fact, they almost certainly will have different retention schedules. And once they've gone to the same storage repository, the ability to manage them to different retention schedules becomes problematic. So if I have data that might become a risk or might become a legal issue, and it co-populates a storage repository with something that has to be kept for 30 years, then clearly one session, one backup session data makes it problematic or forces you to keep something that you don't want to keep for legal reasons or for risk reasons, I would say. And so the ability to remediate data by sessions can be extremely useful. And it can be extremely useful for regulations that might be driven by data privacy, for example. So it may be very difficult to take somebody's PII that might be backed up, maybe, or PHI that might be backed up on a storage repository somewhere. It might be very difficult to take that person's personal information out of a storage repository without taking everything else out. But it can be much easier to, if the whole data class doesn't need to be kept, or a certain data class does need to be kept, it can be a lot more cost effective to actually take only the type of data by class out of the system and maintain the stuff that you have to keep for long term. So in fact, I would hazard a guess that 80 to 90% of the technical development work that our software engineers do in our company are focused around elegant and efficient ways to unravel data rather than restore any particular data. Because I think it's increasingly the case that companies are recognizing the risk and recognizing the potential data privacy challenges and recognizing the regulatory problems, that they may be getting it right from day one forward, but they've got this reservoir of potential risk and potential problems, and unraveling it is the challenge. And we've developed technology, and I think it makes the most sense to try and unravel the data that is at risk of falling foul of a data privacy regulator. It makes sense to unravel it by a session of data, or a server, if you like, of data, rather than the individual custodians themselves.
I agree with that. It's such a tough problem because we're moving in from a situation where a lot of companies, too many companies, say, well, let's just keep everything forever and then we don't need to think about it. But now you really have to think about it, right? Because yep. Now you have all these issues.
So I have a question for you, Debbie, if I can.
Yes, yes.
So, you know, on this topic, it's really, like I mentioned, it's probably 80% of our technical development is unraveling this data. And we see a lot of the data privacy regulations, you know, the one that seems to be the most appropriate one regarding legacy data is the right to be forgotten, or that, you know, that's the term that's been largely used within GDPR. Although a lot of the privacy regulations have something similar, in, you know, where somebody wants their data removed, or somebody requests that the data be removed. So what we don't see a great deal of is where that, you know, we see many instances and sanctions, if you like, where those instructions to remove data is affected. But we don't see too many instances where companies are forced to respond to those right to be forgotten requests on legacy data. And I'd love to get your take on why do you think that is? Is that something, are they going to get sharper teeth as data privacy regulations evolve? Is it a lack of knowledge as to how to go about it, or a lack of ability on how to go about it? Where do you see this developing with regards to legacy data?
Good question. I think a lot of it is around lack of knowledge and lack of ability in some ways. And so in the US, we don't have a right to be forgotten, but in some places we have a right to deletion. And I think sometimes those rights are time bound. So, you know, they don't have to go back forever and ever and take, you know, your data. But then also, you know, it's pretty interesting. So there are some cases, some right to be forgotten cases in Europe, and these are around like Google and stuff like that. So they're basically saying, you know, Google, we want you to de-link this data on the internet. So it doesn't erase the data. It just makes it harder for people to find the data. And so I think also some, there have been some cases, and, you know, this is not a blanket thing altogether, but there have been some cases, especially in legal circles, the thought was that, especially if something was on backup tapes, that it would be too difficult to access or difficult to deal with or too expensive. So I think it's more on a case-by-case basis. So I don't see anything that says, like, you definitely don't have to go into, you know, legacy data or whatever. But I do see, you know, if data is easier to access, you know, in the future, I'm sure that you know, the people who do these cases will probably want to do that. So I think, you know, I remember when people have stuff on premise, and, you know, lawyers would say, oh, we can't, you know, get data from backup tapes because it's not reasonably accessible, right? But that's no longer true, right? With a lot of the technology that you have, some of that stuff is easier to access. It isn't super laborious, or maybe it could be. It probably isn't as expensive as you say. You know, you don't necessarily have to unfurl everything to be able to do that. So I think as more technology comes to bear, I think the capabilities are there to be able to do that. But I think, you know, the people who are asking for this or thinking about it, they need to have more education about what is possible. So I think that the thought had been, oh, it's not reasonably accessible because it's on a backup tape or whatever. It's like, but we know the technology is more sophisticated than that. And it probably, maybe it is, right? Maybe it is. Or maybe they need to change the way that they handle their data retention.
Yep, I couldn't agree with you more. It's you know, the challenges that were evident, and the costs and the challenges that were evident 15 years ago and not necessarily the same today. So yeah, couldn't agree with you more.
Yeah, yeah. Now, one thing I want to talk to you about is obsolescence. And your team does something fascinating that I've not seen anyone do. So I'll give you an example. And then I want you to tell a little bit about the thing that you do around writing software for obsolete, or, you know, obsolete data. So let's say someone had a court order and they had to keep maybe backup tapes or some type of hardware that has data on it for, I don't know, 10 years, 15 years, 20 years. Like, this is not, I have actual cases like this, right? So the problem with that is that, and maybe this is very similar to what you think about legacy data and backup tapes when people, like a right to be forgotten. It's like, if you have a court order where you have to keep that data for this long period of time, the knowledge about what's on those data systems are being lost because people are leaving organizations or retiring. The applications that stored that data are probably no longer available. So in some ways, I think if you feel like you're doing your duty by just locking this data into a room for like 10 years, I think that's a problem. Because also tapes degrade, right? There's degradation there, there's obsolescence there. So tell me about how do you help people in those areas? So they have data they have to keep for some reason. It may be old, it may be legacy. They may not know the software. They may, maybe it's on media that is degrading or going to degrade after some point. How do you handle those situations?
So in terms of tape degrading, you're absolutely right. It does. There's no doubt about it. I think it's largely an old problem, though. I don't think it's, if I was to go back in time 30 years, then I think the vast majority of potential risk due to aging preventing anybody from getting hold of a file that they wanted was probably on the tape. I think these days, the risk of anybody not getting a file is more likely that the software is no longer available or supported, or maybe the hardware is no longer available or supported, or not easily available or supported. The tape itself, it's developed. 30 years ago, it was iron oxide material was largely used to back up, certainly with nine-track tape, and then a better compound that came out was chrome dioxide. And so on 3480 and on various other tape technologies, chrome dioxide was used. And then metal particle or metal pigment was the coating material used. And more recently, it's become barium ferrite and now strontium ferrite on the latest LTO tape technologies. So each of those materials that have been used in backup tape, as they get harder and harder. And they require weaker and weaker or a lower and lower signal to be able to read the flux transition or the actual bit of data, the one or the zero that's recorded. So they last longer on the tape surface. They require less current to read, and the particles are much harder, which means that the stuff that we used to see, like edge damage to tape or debris being generated, is much, much less. So I would say that if you have purchased a tape technology in the last 10 to 15 years, you're going to be reading that in 30 plus years' time. It's much more solid. Now, in terms of the software, what we do is we write routines to enable data to be read from not just tapes, but also from things like, disk environments like data domain. We write routines from all of these backup softwares that essentially trick the storage media, whether it be tape or disk, into believing it's in the original environment that it was in. And here's what that means. If a backup and recovery software company develops a backup software 15 years ago and no longer supports it 5 years later because there's a new latest, greatest way of backing up data, then when we get that storage media into our engineers' hands, they write routines, they understand how they learn from looking at the data at its lowest, at its rawest level, and they work out how that data was backed up to that storage media, and then they write code that enables that data to be restored in a standard Windows environment. So we can pick up something that might have been created in a Unisys, a Unix, a Sun Solaris, AIX, AS400, MVS, all of these environments that have thousands of different backup routines that have been created over the last 30 years. We create a repository in our own software that can call upon each one of those emulators that trick the media into believing it's in that environment and therefore get hold of the data. And so what that means is, with the case in point that you had, that if somebody locks it in a room and that software or the hardware is no longer available, we've got a repository of code probably written that will read it. And if it hasn't, then we'll be able to read the data at a hex level and figure out how to write routines to restore it. So that's kind of it can be extremely effective, not just for restoring the whole file, but for also learning about the data in itself at a metadata level. So often, you know, 9 out of 10 times you can make decisions on data based on the metadata rather than the content itself. So it can provide a lot of elegant ways to do that also.
Yeah. I thought that was fascinating when I saw you and your team do that, because that's such a huge problem that people had. They thought, oh my God, the software, I don't have it. The hardware, I don't know how to access it. How do I get this data? How do I use it or get insights? It's really cool. Well, one thing I want to talk to you about is air gapping. First of all, we'll talk about, maybe you can explain to people what that is. And the reason why I'm bringing this up is I remember, you know, maybe I'm dating myself now, right? So back in the day when I started working in technology environments, I remember we used to have meetings about whether we're going to put something on the internet. Right. So now it seems like everything is connected to the internet. Everything is either on the internet. And so I think, you know, one area that people can go to try to reduce some of their risk is not putting everything on the internet. So give me an idea of why, first of all, what is air gapping and why that could be a benefit to people in terms of securing their data.
So an air gap is simply a computer system or a piece of data that is not connected to the internet. It's as simple as that. And so when anybody or any company acquires a backup environment or any kind of computer environment, if it's connected to the internet, then it is not air gapped. And I'm a large tape advocate, as you might guess from somebody that's been around in the tape industry since 1985. It's certainly not appropriate these days to use tape for backup. There are far more effective backup solutions out there than just using tape. For archive, I think it's still the perfect media. And the three factors that makes it a perfect media is that it lasts a long time, it's portable, secure, and it's unhackable. You can't hack a piece of data that's not air gapped, certainly that's residing on a piece of tape. So, and increasingly, you know, when dealing with companies' risk departments, this is what they want to know. They want to know that if you're going to be working on my data, you know, everybody that's ever done a risk assessment, a vendor assessment, you know, any vendor, they've had these 60-page documents that come from financial services firms or other firms. And there seems to be 20 to 30 pages that are, you know, tell me about your vulnerability testing, tell me about your penetration testing and all this kind of stuff. And we run systems that are air gapped. And what that means is that it really is irrelevant, because the data that we work on is static. It's inaccessible on the internet and we process it separately. So that, you know, that is what the air gap is, and that is why it's critical, certainly in our space of servicing clients that are highly regulated, have risk at the top of their mind, and obviously involved in regular litigations, they want to know that their vendor and service providers have air gap solutions. So even within our data centers, outside of tape obviously being the easiest definition of an air gap media, we have air gap intranets within our company that we don't, you can't log into them from outside. Their network is internal.
That's great. That's great. I love. I'm glad you guys are doing this. I was very impressed with the way you all handle yourself. You know, let's talk a little bit about chain of custody, I guess. Okay. So chain of custody is kind of a boring term, I guess, but it's very vital in terms of who has data, what they're doing with it, and having that chain of custody in terms of knowing who has what will definitely lower your risk profile, because then you know what your exposure is. Talk to me a little bit about the importance of chain of custody in data.
So if you're in computer forensics, and you talk to potential clients about chain of custody, it largely starts and ends with, you know, here's my laptop and I'm handing it over to you and here's the serial number and here's who I am and will you sign here that you've received it and I'll give you my signature back when I hand it back. And that's a chain of custody. And then whenever once that chain of custody has been transferred, then you're responsible for that that asset, that digital data asset, and until it gets handed back. And that, you know, it's part of an evidentiary route that is important. But chain of custody is a much more detailed event, especially when dealing with major corporations and highly regulated industries, in that it's not just the vendor or the recipient of the media that needs to be involved, or that is often required to be involved. At a much more extensive level, it's a tracking of both the physical asset and the digital assets within that physical asset throughout the whole process. It's audit trails, it's logs that are created at every stage of the processing of data, so that the data controllers, so to speak, that might ultimately end up being the data processors of data that you receive. It's have I got your media, whether it be a laptop or a backup tape or a disk? B, when did you assign control? C, where was it when it was in your organization? And D, where did the data go once it was in your organization? And then I think we're up to E or F. And then what people had access to it? When did they have access to it? When did they pick it up? When did they hand it over? And then finally, how was it modified, if it was modified? So chain of custody documents that we often see with highly regulated big businesses can end up being 25-page documents or more from the time that the asset is picked up to the time that the asset is either destroyed or handed back. So it can be an extremely extensive piece of tracing of every part of that data and that physical asset that's involved.
And I think from a privacy perspective, we're going to see a lot more emphasis on, especially like you said, those tracking, those logs, like the audit trail about who touches data, because some of these, laws, not just data breaches, right? So data breach is one thing, but then we're seeing a lot of companies get in trouble for unauthorized access, right? So it's not necessarily a, quote unquote breach, but if someone has some type of unauthorized access, there are probably some type of audit trail that exists there that tells either that happened or it didn't happen, right? So I think that we're just getting in a very data intensive part of the world or part of life right now, especially because there's so much onus on maybe the lineage of data, like where, you know, who has it, where did it come from, where does it go to, who has access. So,
yeah, you're right, Debbie, and I might you know broadly classify that as just defensibility. Increasingly, you have to have demonstrated defensible processes, and that means chain of custody, tracking, logs, metadata at every single stage of the process, and that can be the larger part of the actual work that needs to be done.
Yeah, I agree with that. So, if it were the world according to Brendan, and we did everything you said, what would be your wish for either privacy or data handling? What do you want in the future if you had your wish in terms of how people handle data?
So I think it's a good question. So I think there's some silliness in the world of data privacy regulation. Right now, I think it's an evolving area. You know, obviously, there's been not just talk, there's been a lot of work towards more federal data privacy regulations in the US, and Europe has largely led, but there's still some real silliness, and I'll elaborate from my perspective what it looks to be a little silly.
Yeah,
you know, there's Google in France, for example, if you search something here, you don't have authority to view it outside of this country, but yet the internet is everywhere. And so, you know, so how do you apply a regulation to a particular country when it's so clearly easy to breach that regulation? You know, if I was to view data in any other country, then I would simply get a VPN in that country and I would simply go and view it. So, you know, there's regulations that appear to me to be created, and, you know, huge amounts of money and time go into creating these regulations when they're so easy to breach and they're so easy to not be enforced. And so I think, to translate that to a wish, you know, this is not a country problem. This is a global problem, and I believe that data privacy regulations can only truly be solved in the modern world at a global level. And so maybe more time and effort spent between countries on creating standards than having bodies that develop various regulations in each individual country. Would that be too much of an ask, do you think, Debbie? I don't know.
That's a great ask. I would love it. I talk about that a lot too, because I feel like we all have the same problems, even though we're in different jurisdictions. So I feel like we probably have so many of similar problems that maybe if we can come up with some baseline understanding, you know, about some baseline things, so we can actually get more done. So I agree with that.
Yeah, and if you kind of follow through from that wish, you know, it shows itself in huge inefficiencies as a result of it. Right, we again different countries create things like safe harbors. Or yes, you can look at my data, but only if you're in this country or only if you're in this certain jurisdiction, or maybe I can create a safe harbor for this, but not for that. And if there was a much more standardized global regulatory oversight, then, you know, those could be dramatically simplified as well, which would really lower cost and make discovery a lot simpler, I think.
Yeah, I agree with that. And I'll also add on to your wish, is that I wish that a lot of these regulations were written with how technology works in mind. So some of the things that are written, it's like, well, that's not how technology works. So you're asking for something that first of all, it either can't be done or can't be done efficiently, or people try to develop something to answer that question that doesn't exist. So I think we're kind of chasing our tail and some of the stuff.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, it was great having you on the show. I really enjoyed spending time with you and your team and people that you know in Atlanta. And I'm happy that people get to listen to this episode, because I feel like everybody, all companies have to do backup of some sort, right? So these are problems that almost any company can have. So being able to shine a light on this, and this to me, you know, the legacy part of data, or kind of the end of life stage of data, this is where I feel like a lot of companies fall down. So being able to have someone like you who knows a lot about that, I think is really helpful to the audience.
Excellent. Thanks so much, Debbie. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you. Talk to you soon.
Will do. Bye.